Thank you, Roger Miller. Appreciate your thoughts on government, sir. And you have two folks here who certainly agree with you. Isn't that right, Mark? I'm sorry, Mark. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. I thought I'd lost you there for a second.
Yeah.
Jumping back to Luther Martin, Luther Martin had written a supremacy clause, and he had also written some requirements for the Supreme Court, and those had been accepted by the Committee of the Whole, and they were actually part of the Constitution that was sent to the Committee of Style and Arrangement. Now, the Committee of Style and Arrangement were all lawyers. Imagine that.
Yeah,
but here was the thing that was amazing, what Luther Martin had put in. And think about if we had this today, all Supreme Court trials would have a jury. And the jury would hear the Supreme Court discuss the case, and then they would vote on it, which would put the control back into the hands of the people again. But, you know, they got Gouverneur Marsh quickly took that out in the Committee of Style and Arrangement. And the other thing that he wanted was that the way he had written the Supremacy Clause, no case would go to the Supreme Court except when two state Supreme Courts disagreed on the same subject. So there wouldn't be this group of people who were Brutus said, I believe he said that they had the final decision this side of heaven, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So here we are with just something totally different. And also, I think it's important that the people understand was that a Bill of Rights was proposed in the last days by Elbridge Gerry. Elbridge Gerry made a motion for a Bill of Rights. It was seconded by George Mason. And George Mason, again, speaks up for a Bill of Rights. Of course, he had written the Virginia Declaration of Rights.
Yep.
And so he speaks up for it. And then, of course, you know, it goes, the people say, well, no, we've been here for 3.5 months now. It's hot. We don't have time to draft a Bill of Rights. We don't have time to do this. To which Franklin answered, I'm sorry, not Franklin, but George Mason answered, and he said, look, we've got 9 states with their Bill of Rights. We've got them right here on paper. So why don't we just take a few hours and take out the rights that we believe the people should have and incorporate it into a Bill of Rights? And why don't we do that now? Well, he was voted down 10-0.
Yeah.
They wanted no rights for the people.
Nope.
And the other thing, I just kind of wanted to throw in here about Robert Morris before we leave him in the dust, was that Robert Morris was one of the first senators from Pennsylvania in the brand new government created by a constitution that he had helped write. Let's also not forget that there's a statue in Chicago that nobody's going to tear down, I promise you, because in that statue is George Washington in the center, Robert Morris to his right, and Haim Solomon to his left. And ironically, even in the statue, Haim Solomon and George Mason are doing a Masonic handshake. So here we have these things that people don't know, but during when the amendments had been sent to the first Congress by the various states, and that was probably the only reason they got it ratified in Virginia and New York. As a matter of fact, New York made that a part of their ratification that there would be a Bill of Rights. And so then we end up with Robert Morris sending a letter. James Madison introduces and says, okay, let's move to put the Bill of Rights in here. Madison had to. This was not Madison being Mr. Good Guy. He had been able to get Virginia to ratify the Constitution by promising a Bill of Rights, And then when he was running for Congress, Patrick Henry worked his backside off to make sure that James Madison wasn't a senator from Virginia. And he accomplished his mission because William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee were the senators. But then Madison then knew he had to get into that government somehow. So he came. Yep. He was in New York, so he takes a carriage back, and which really bothered him, according to his notes, because he had hemorrhoids. So he comes back from New York to Virginia and runs for Congress opposing James Monroe. And Patrick Henry did everything in his power to gerrymander the district to try to keep Madison out totally.
Yep.
But he didn't succeed. But anyway, at the convention, Madison is pushing for a Bill of Rights because he knows his political career hinges on that. And so he pushed for a Bill of Rights, but while this is going on, Robert Morris writes a letter to Francis Hopkinson, a member of the House of Representatives, and in that letter, Mark, he says, if, you know, he talks about Madison goes on and on and on about amendments. I think Madison dreams amendments because he's so afraid of Patrick Henry.
Yeah.
So then Morris makes the astounding comment, if they pass the right amendment, I will hang. It's in his own letter.
See, these are the important nuggets that people have to know, and only because it gives a kind of color to this whole event that heretofore we have all fawned over. We've all been told to fawn over it. I mean, every September 17th, we have Constitution Day, and we spend the day, you know, devoted thinking about something that, in most cases, most well-meaning constitutional conservatives know absolutely nothing about. Like, they don't know what Article 6 is. They don't know what Article 5 is. They don't even know really how Article 1, 2, and 3 work with each other. But they've learned the term Constitution from the likes of Levin and Limbaugh and Beck and all those guys over the years. And they've somehow created they've associated themselves with an identity of being a constitutionalist without really knowing anything about the Constitution. And then when you do a deep dive like you're doing and we're doing today on the show, these are nuggets that validate the contention that the whole thing was a coup at the end of the day. And even Morris, I've not read that letter, and I'm going to look for it and read it now because I'm curious, knowing that if I get caught, if the right amendment shows up, I'm going to hang. Well, it's no wonder, you know, in many ways, Madison kind of has to shepherd those through the Congress, because I think, if I recall, there were like somewhere around 200 amendments offered by all the states. I mean, the states were, some people in the states were terrified of this Constitution, and they're trying to amend it. Now, some of them were duplicate amendments from one state to another and just carryovers, or kind of carryovers. But, you know, at the end of the day, you winnow roughly 200 amendments down to 12 and 10 make it. And you got to imagine Morris is sitting there just, making sure Madison knows which ones not to present to the states for ratification. But this, you can't help but begin to think sinister about all these discussions. And I ran into Morris really for the first time in a significant way when I read William McClay's, the senator from Pennsylvania, his notes on the first Senate, and you run into Morris, and you run into some of the guys that are in the first Senate were at the convention, and you begin to see the work begin right there of what they really wanted to do, which was expand central power over the people and fundamentally over the states, the people of the states. And so these are not the people that we've been told they are. And it's time we just be honest about it.
Well, that is so true, Mark. Very, very well said. And yes, there are so many things I think people don't see about how this was done. And you have to understand that Washington stated publicly there would be no anti-federalist in his administration. And so there weren't any, and he made sure of that. But then there were some that were elected by the people from the states. Now, there were only two anti-Federalists in the Senate, which meant that the Federalists controlled the Senate 20-2. But the two senators were Grayson and Richard Henry Lee, both from Virginia. And in the House of Representatives, it was 49-11 that the anti-Federalists were overruled. So they couldn't get anything by. Now, if you go back again to these source documents, Mark, there were tons of Federalists writing letters. Richard Peters, quite a few people were writing letters to Madison telling him to forget the darn amendments. The government's in place. And there were even some letters like from Richard Peters who said, look, we haven't finished building this government yet. Because there were things we couldn't get by with that the people would never ratify. So now, and then they did the Judicial Act of 1789, which was totally unconstitutional. So they were not finished. And here's the thing I think most people don't understand. And that is very simply, you know, that 67% of the people at the Constitutional Convention were in the first government. 67%. And here's the question, and then I want to get to a caller. We've got Jay in Los Angeles standing by. Be right with you, Jay. But here's one of the things that people need to understand when they look at these statistics and look at these figures and look at the facts. And where do you find these facts? You're going to find them in original source documents. And, you know, and that's not coming from your Marxist universities or the local gulag where you send your children. But anyway, let me jump in here. Mark, let's take a call from Jay out in Los Angeles. Jay, how are you, sir?
Hey, guys, thanks for taking my call. This is probably a very basic question considering the vast knowledge you both have, but I'm kind of new to all this, really interested in what you all are saying. I've been listening to a few other shows, like Roger Shales and different people who talk about how the 14th and 13th Amendment created the federal citizen and took us out of the free status of being state citizen. I was wondering what you guys thought about that, and it sounds like what you're saying is that these founding fathers that a lot of us idolized and thought were noble actually had the intent to enslave us right from the get-go. And if that's the case, then was the whole thing... did they have the plan to make a federal citizen right from the gate of the creation of this country, or did it get co-opted by the usual suspects along the way?
Well, the Constitution itself, Jay, says that the only people who can run for office must be U.S. citizens. So if you want to say, did they establish it? I think so. But the 14th Amendment didn't establish anything because the 14th Amendment was never properly ratified. And the people who will say, well, the 14th Amendment this, the 14th Amendment that, are granting the federal government the power to do any darn thing they want to.
Yeah.
If you acknowledge that the 14th Amendment was actually, it's actually law, then you acknowledge that the federal government can do whatever they want to.
Good point. So when you say... what about the idea that they created the corporation of the United States versus United States of America? Is that true? Was that also from the beginning?
The corporation was created with the preamble. We the people is a separate entity from the people of the United States of America. If you read the preamble, two separate entities. If you look at 28 U.S.C. 3002A. It plainly stipulates that the United States is a corporation.
Wow, so was that way right from its inception?
Well, the U.S. Code wasn't made then, but that was certainly their intentions. I don't think there's any doubt about that, that they realized, because they did mention corporations in a couple of their letters between themselves. They mentioned the fact of corporations. Alexander Hamilton was all over that. And James Duane was all over that as well in their letters about being a corporation. But the thing that we know is that Gouverneur Morris completely rewrote the Constitution, and he changed everything with the preamble. Now, I did a program, a podcast, which was a dissecting the Constitution and the preamble. Mark, you've heard that. What are your thoughts?
No, I think that was an excellent program, and I would encourage you to find it and listen to it. And I would ask you just to consider one thing, because I think your instincts are exactly headed in the right direction. You're trying to solve what happened and when did it happen. And the caution is really to be careful with the people that are saying things happened post-Constitution that led to this. And really focus your energies on exactly what Mike and I are talking about today, and Mike's talking in his other podcast, Dissecting the Constitution. That is the source. You know, we've got to, like, it's very similar in a good parallel, and you probably are familiar with this. When someone has a cancer in their body, the doctor is trying to find the source of that. Where did it come from? Now, you may have some cells in your liver, but the real source of it was a tumor in your lungs. And so there's a lot of interesting organizations out there and movements that are really trying to get people to focus on the 14th Amendment and the corporation idea. And I totally get the allure, so don't mishear me on that. But really, none of those conversations are relevant if you really come to grips with the coup that occurred in 1787. Let me give you one example of this, and Mike is going to be familiar with this, and you may be as well. But in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 or 18, depending on how you look at it, the Necessary and Proper Clause.
18.
Most conservatives can... Wait, I'm sorry?
No, 18. You're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So most conservatives will quote that the foregoing... That laws can be created related to the foregoing powers, and then there's a comma... and all other powers contained within the Constitution. Now, most conservatives like to quote up to the comma, that, and then they'll make the argument that, see, it's a limited government because they're not allowed to create laws related to anything except for the previous 17 enumerated powers in Article 1 and a few other enumerated powers in Article 1. Well, after the comma, it says, and all other laws, you know, related to departments and the government powers related to the departments and government. So then you turn the page over to Article 2, Section 2, and you find this mysterious appointments clause where it's written in that the executive branch, the president, is allowed to appoint ministers and department heads and all these other elements of the growing government as long as the power is vested in them by the Congress. So we tend to think of this concept of limited government that the Congress can only do what those 17 powers say. And that's just not true at all, because after the comma associated with Article 2, Section 2, whatever agency the president concocts, as long as he can get Congress to do it and legitimize it, well, that agency is now going to tyrannize you. It's going to tyrannize you. And what do we have? We have the growth of agencies in our lives. Where did that come from? It didn't come from the 14th Amendment. It didn't come from whether we're a corporate citizen or not. It came from a conflation of two sections of Article 1 and Article 2. These are the conversations that we have to become very familiar with, and discussions and understanding that was done by design. That comma wasn't accidentally put there. And to Mike's point about the Committee on Style and Arrangement, Gouverneur Morris essentially rewrote the Constitution there, and because the draft related to the preamble. And Mike did a great podcast on this. The draft was... we, the states, but they couldn't do that because Rhode Island wasn't there. So they couldn't say we, the states, because only 12, and really by then Yates and Lansing are gone, so you've only got Alexander Hamilton in New York. So they don't, it's not really, like, he can't vote for the entire state of New York, though in his mind I'm sure he thought he could. So you've really got, at the convention, represented in some official capacity of the 13 states at that point. You've got 11 there. And so you can't very well say we, the states, because two aren't really functionally there. So Gouverneur Morris has to make the change to we the people. And as Mike alluded earlier, that begins this corporate sense of this collective is now a nation and it's made up of the people, and supposedly we're all behind the Constitution and we wrote it, and all this flowery stuff that comes after this. So, brother, if I were you, I'd follow your instincts. It was new to me at one point, but the more I chased the facts, the more I came to realize the problem was the summer of 1787. That was the problem.
Well stated, Mark, and very, very good analogy. Jay, one of the things I would like for you to think about, and that is this, is that when the first Congress was in session, Thomas Tudor Tucker, who was a anti-federalist from the state of South Carolina, he made a motion on two occasions to put the word expressly in front of delegated powers.
Yep.
And he made the motion. Now, what James Madison said is something, and James Madison led the assault. Of course, they were outnumbered. They didn't have a chance of getting it in, but I got to give Thomas Tudor Tucker credit, because he said, no, that word expressly, the government can only have expressly delegated powers, to which James Madison stated, no government can be held to its expressly delegated powers. All governments must have the power of implication. Now, folks, if that destroyed it right there, because it said the government can do any darn thing it wants to, and it's been doing it ever since. Because how many people are aware that within just a short period of time, George Washington violated the Constitution 3 times? And nobody was going to say anything because it was George Washington who did it.
Right.
So, and then at the ratification convention, none other than Patrick Henry brought it up so eloquently by saying, if they decide, and I'm not saying it anywhere near as eloquently as Patrick Henry did, but what he in essence said, well, if these people with this government that they have just created, if they do something that they're not allowed to do, how are you going to stop them?
Right. Right.
And what was there are no powers.
No. And as you alluded to, Mike, earlier, Henry goes on to also say, who gave you the authority to say we
the people?
We the people, and not we the states.
Right. Well, Mark, I think we should also bring up that there was only one state that gave the authority to the people to vote for the Constitution, for or against. That state was Rhode Island, ratification was defeated by 92% of the people in the state of Rhode Island said they didn't want the Constitution. So we the people on my backside.
Yeah.
Where can I catch that show you mentioned where you really break down the Constitution?
This is a project that my good friend Daryl Wayne kind of taxed me with 2 weeks ago. He and I were talking, and I said, you know what I would really like to do for the people who really want to know is I would like to take the Constitution, just take it totally apart, a postmortem, if you will, to take it apart and to show each article, each clause, each section, to show from both sides original source documents that deal with each issue. I am working on Article 1, Section 1 right now, not at this time, but as this week I've been working on Article 1, Section 1, because I did the preamble last week. Now, it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort to go through these clause by clause by clause, but I think America needs to know this. I think the people need it. So, as I said, it's going to be a time-consuming effort, but Jay, if you will find some way, maybe leave it with RBN here, leave them a contact information, I will get you a copy of that podcast to you, sir.
Okay, do you have an email to reach you, or should I just speak to, try to speak to someone there?
Sure, I don't mind at all. My email address is very simple. It's michael.d.gaddy at gmail.com.
G-A-D-D-I?
G-A-D-D-Y.
At what? Sorry?
At Gmail.
Okay, are there any other, is there one or two books that you guys recommend for somebody like me to cut their teeth on? Because it is obviously such a deep topic. It would be kind of like where the 101 class, you know?
Well, if you want a 101 book, I would highly recommend a book by a guy who used to live in Colorado. He's now in Wyoming, I think, a guy I've met personally, talked to on several occasions when I was living in Colorado. He used to live in Bayfield. His name is Kenneth Royce, R-O-Y-C-E, but he wrote under the pseudonym of Boston Tea Party. And he wrote a book called The Hologram of Liberty.
Wow.
And I would, as a primer, I would highly recommend that. He does not go into the detail that I wished he had of, but at that time, you know, writing 30 years ago, he laid the groundwork, and he did include quite a bit on Hamilton and quite a bit on Washington that are very relevant. But if you wanted a primer, I would recommend that, sir.
Okay. And as far as how people believe they can remove themselves from this kind of federal citizen, do you think that that's actually not true, that there is no way to remove yourself from that status?
Well, here's the thing. There are certain things where that will work, Jay, but the people who will tell you it will completely take you out of the rule of the federal government, they are preaching a lie.
Yeah.
Because it will not happen. I promise you, it will not happen. And here's the reason why. I know some people who have gone into federal court and said, look, here's my status. Here's my affidavit. Here's my stuff. One judge in Arkansas, a federal judge, looked at him after he produced all of his stuff, and he said, well, you can take that up on appeal, young man. Today we're having a trial. And recently, in the January 6th, folks, there was a lady who presented all of her documents in a bail hearing and said, look, you have no jurisdiction over me. And the judge said, and it's on tape, the judge said, lady, I don't give a damn what your status is.
Yeah. Yep, that's scary.
So here's the thing I have told people. Yes, there are some benefits to that. I'm not going to tell you there isn't. But you need to talk to people who are much more well-versed in that than I am. The thing I don't want Americans to do is to go this route and think that now nobody can touch me.
Amen.
Because here's the thing I've asked so many times. When that cattle wagon full of BATF agents pulled up at Mount Carmel and they jumped out and started shooting, did they ask anybody what their status was?
True.
So, yes, I'm not going to tell you not to pursue it, not to look at it, because I think that it would be of benefit to do that, but do not expect it to be the blanket coverage and you are now exempt from everything, because that's not going to happen. Because these people who have worked as hard as they have for 234 years to control the lives of everyone are not going to give this up and go, uh-oh, you got me, I'm going home now, it's over.
Right. Right.
It's not going to happen. So, Jay, any other questions we might answer for you, sir?
I could probably ask you a million. I just don't want to monopolize the show. I'll just keep listening to you guys. And
if you have another one, throw it at us. We've got Murr holding on, but I know she's patient.
Oh, okay. You can take her. I'll just listen to you guys. Maybe I'll call in next week or something.
All right, well, we got some music coming. We'll be back on the flip side.
And if you plan on getting out alive, best be on our way. Our tattered gray was torn between if we should run or fight. But our southern pride swelled up inside as we dug in for the night. Then I heard a rider calling, they're coming down the road. And the fiery flash of 20 pounds.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Extendivite really works. Here's just a few testimonials from Amazon. Patricia, excellent herbal formula. I use Extendivite to keep my cardiovascular system fine-tuned. Brian, I'm using Extendivite, and for me, it has made a world of difference. God made all these nutrients in the ground. Enough said. Cammy, 5 stars. I feel a lot of energy since I started taking Extendivite. TR, 5 stars. All I can say is, Extendivite works. Buy it, try it, and see for yourself. To get your Extendivite today, go to extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
It used to be Andy and Barney 5. Now a tired Stern and a brothel life. Too much crap drive the world insane. Everybody singing the jailhouse blues.
Way to go, Merle. That's just absolutely beautiful. May you rest in peace, sir. You were such a treasure for this country for so long. Still are. And, Mark, let's jump to the lady from Wisconsin here. Mer, how you doing today, girl?
Well, hi, Mike and Mark. Good to hear both of you.
Hi.
And so much in-depth from both of you. And you can't hear this enough, much like some other subjects, but... And especially when I heard Jay, but I was already on because I wanted to tell everyone about the rebelmadmanradio.chatango.com, and I will post in there the links for, you've done the preamble so far, the American National Radio Network.podbeam that Stephen Whitener posts a lot of things to, different shows, but a lot of what you do, Mike, so it's good to find it there. There's some couple other spots, and I'll post all that in the chat, but there's also the statue that you mentioned in Chicago. And I found a site that by a Jewish man that about national monuments and things, and it's very interesting, different timings about how that went down that I didn't realize before, and a much longer inscription. So you can find them there. And I recognize Jay's voice from over on the Jitsi platform where a lot of us gather and can't seem to get away from a lot of times, but that's how you share things, you know. That's how you learn.
Well, thank you, Mer, for that. That's fantastic, lady. I certainly appreciate you doing that.
And that's amazing what you did with the preamble, too. And I like you're teaching true history on the Telegram channel. I'm not on Telegram. I'm not on any of the social networks. So it's really nice when you or others post them different places. And Stephen does that also at his site. And the one about Patrick Henry, that was just so good. I really like that. Because you don't hear hardly anything about him anywhere. And that's a clue. Whenever you don't hear about some, you know that there's too much good there. And then when you hear that they're promoted all over the place, you know, like that guy there, and you know, is trying to look like God along the Potomac in the big white throne in his temple. Yeah. The Melungian. You have to look up what Melungian is, but that's what he was.
Well, Mer, a question, girl. Do you think that the... I think it's twofold myself, but I'd like your opinion, then I'd like to get Mark's opinion. Do you think that we do not talk about Patrick Henry because Patrick Henry was very outspoken about his only purpose in life was to stand for liberty in so many ways, but also among the people we call founders and framers, they were in almost unanimous agreement that he was the most devout Christian among the bunch. His last hours certainly show that to be a fact. I mean, there he is preaching to the doctor who's at his bedside as he's passing away, who's trying to take his doctor to Christ. And he's also, you know, look at his will. What's the first thing he left to his children? The Christian faith. I mean, you know, is that the reason that you think that we don't hear that much about Patrick Henry?
Definitely. You know, this country's been turned away from God and Jesus Christ. And in fact, there is only Christ and Antichrist. And you brought out how when we were talking about what's known as the Confederate flag, but it's St. Andrew's Cross flag, actually, how that is so demonized. But yet there were four flags in the Confederacy, right? So that one's singled out. And it's even the stained glass of it was removed from the cathedral in D.C., so we're in a battle, and it's Christ or Antichrist, you know, and the one that's peaceful and calm is our Savior, and the stuff that just rattles on and doesn't have any patience or morals, we can see what side that is.
Well, very well said. Mark, your comments on Patrick Henry, do we have the reason he is snubbed historically? Is that both because he was a valiant fighter for liberty, give me liberty or give me death, or was it because he's a Christian, or both?
Well, I would probably say both, but I think his statements, give me liberty, give me death, kind of flow from his Christianity, and as they do from mine right now. So the natural trajectory of liberty finds its source in Christianity, in God. And so when he's arguing that way, and you know, you have to snub him. You've got to remove this spiritual dimension from these arguments these discussions that we're having right now. Because, as Jesus himself said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Truth is central right now. It is absolutely central. So even the discussions we're having, we're exposing lies with factual truth, because truth has to matter. If it doesn't, this is one of my great concerns as an evangelical myself and a former pastor. I don't like weaponizing Jesus Christ in these debates, because I don't think he wants to be weaponized. I think he wants truth, but truth will inevitably lead you to liberty and freedom. This is that path that I'm on right now, of constitutional conservative to minarchist to libertarian for 6 hours, now to why do we have to have these things? Let's ask those questions. Now, with all the backdrop of what we're talking about today, when we do have these things called government, look at what they all do inevitably. Inevitably, they turn on the people. They turn on the people that just want to go to ball games. They just want to work. They want to build their house. They You know, they have all these personal interests in their small community. You want to be left alone, but there's this other group of psychopaths, sociopaths, perhaps narcissistic personality disorders where they have no conscience, find their way in control of these things. And then they do what they did back in 1789. Mike, is what we were just talking about with the Judiciary Act of 1789. Read the footnote on Section 25 of that. They know what they're doing has no constitutional basis. They know it, and they don't care. They don't care. So the whole, you know, facade of Philadelphia gets unwound. I mean, if we've got New Hampshire ratifying in June of 1788 and the first Senate, you know, convening in April of 1789, S1 is their first thing to do. let's start binding down the states immediately. Well, because the whole thing was a ruse for deception. And we as Christians have to pursue truth wherever it leads us. And so my drive for everything we're doing and engaged in is truth, because it's what Jefferson said. We all know the famous saying, you know, question with boldness even the very existence of God. Question everything with boldness. Well, I think we all have to start questioning everything, because anything we've been taught has been found to be deficient at protecting liberty completely. But worse than that, it's created a monster that is now, you know, telling you take the jab or you lose your job, which is just one step away from take the jab. I heard an interview the other day from Alan Dershowitz saying back in 2020, he said, yeah, the Constitution permits the government to take you into the doctor's office and plunge a needle into your arm. And I thought to myself, well, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, when I was a Limbaughite, I would have said, no, it doesn't. Now I say, yes, it does. It enables you to do anything. It enables government to do anything it wants to do. There are no restraints. And Mike, can I take 1 second and quote those two sections of the Constitution that I butchered and mangled with my bad memory?
Please do, Mark. Go ahead.
So I talked to a couple of law professors about this, actually, and we had a good conversation about these two sections. So Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 is the necessary and proper clause, and it reads, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, those previous 17 powers, and and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or office thereof. Now, in most cases, I've heard conservatives stop at that comma. To make all laws that shall be necessary and proper for the carrying into execution the foregoing powers. And they will then state, see, it's right there written that the Congress cannot do anything other than what was listed in those foregoing 17 powers, and perhaps they'll even add in a few more. But after the comma, and all other powers. Well, what are those powers? What are those mysterious powers we might be referring to? Well, you find them over in Article 2, Section 2. What I alluded to was the appointments clause, and the president shall be commander in chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. When called into action, he may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each executive department upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have the power. Well, no, I'm reading the wrong section. Excuse me one second here. Here it is. He shall have the power by and with the advising consent of the Senate to make treaties, provide 2/3 of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But Congress may, by law, vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper, in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the head of the department. So those two combined, Article 1, Section 8, Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 2, Section 2, Advice and Consent, the Appointments Clause, gives the government the power to do anything it wants. Create any head you want. Create any department you want. Any officer you want. Well, I didn't know that for 58 of my 64 years of life. Well, I know it now, and it's like, we have to find a way out of this, because they literally can do anything they want. And the only thing that will expose this are these kinds of conversations.
Well, that's exactly true. And just the one thing I want to throw in, and then we'll jump to our next caller, Murr, if you don't mind. But the one point I wanted to throw in was on June the 4th, when the Virginia Ratification Convention opens, the very first statement out of Patrick Henry's mouth was, "I am here to represent the people of my state, and I am here to defend their liberty."
Mm.
Now, who else? Find me a Federalist who ever said anything like that.
Great point.
Doesn't exist.
Great.
Very, very good job there, Mark. Very good. Let's jump to Ed in Chicago. And thanks, Murr. Appreciate you, girl. Ed, how are you?
Hi. You hear me? All right. Hi, Mike. Honored to talk to both of you. And you do all the things you realize that you didn't realize about the Constitution, about everything. I got dragged to that stage play Hamilton a few years back, and I didn't realize that most of the founding fathers were black.
Well, but anyway, yeah, that's an awakening, right?
Wow. I did want to make one quick comment, and you guys are so eloquent with everything you're talking about, but I did want to say, if you read that whole Patrick Henry speech, you know, at the end he says, "Give me liberty, give me death," but during it, he says, "When do we fight back?" I'm not quoting, but when do we fight back? When mm-hmm. we're totally shackled?
Yes.
When do we, you know, when? That was during the revolution, and we're kind of in that situation now. What do we do? You know. But anyway, thank you, fellas. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Yes, Ed, and he also said something very interesting in there as well. And this is something we need to adhere to today, because I hear this an awful lot from people, and they will say, "Oh, well, you know, I hope things get better. I hope the next election. I hope this." Patrick Henry said in that speech, "We shall listen to that siren song of hope until we are all turned into beasts."
Right. Yeah. Very good.
And look around you at how your fellow Americans are acting today. I think
they hope
that's
they hope they get Trump back and stuff like that.
My goodness,
yeah,
Ed.
Right.
Don't.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Ed. Appreciate your call. You have any more questions or comments, sir?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Ed. Well, let's jump to Ahmed in Massachusetts. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gaddy, and good afternoon, Mark. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting discussion, partly hinging on hope, which I just heard. So hopium is also a substance in the same line that I hope something like this happens and so on. But I wanted some guidance from Mark, because he was reading the Constitution. I just want to learn from him that we have these three-letter agencies, and the agency head is supposed to be nominated by the president and approved by the Senate. But how come CDC does not have that requirement? Because I remember when Dr. Rachel Walensky was appointed, she was just appointed straight by the White House and did not have to go through Senate confirmation. So why is that exception, or does that hint of CDC being not a federal agency, private organization, or something like that? So that's what
this is a great question. And this, my experience working in Congress actually can help me a little bit here. What what the face of structure within the created within the Constitution, Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3, is only for PR. Like, there are, and then each House, the House and the Senate, can establish rules for how they do certain things. And but they can also violate those rules when they want to violate them, and they can create smoke screens of voting by voice vote, and I've been in votes where there's been the yeas and nays have been asked for, and the speaker will say, those in favor say aye, those in favor say no, and if you're on the aye side, you might hear 15. Representatives say aye, then you hear 300 say nay, and the speaker will still say, and the ayes have it. it is a game up there. There are agendas going on. Like, for instance, why was I, as a 28-year-old staffer, invited to a 7-course meal at a 5-star restaurant? I'm not going to name the organization that did. And took me out to this wonderful dinner because they wanted legislation. They wanted language in legislation. And guess what I did? I went and put the language in the legislation. So when you see things that seem to be out of sorts, like a Walensky not being, and I don't know the specifics of that. I'm guessing you have a better handle on that than I do, whether she was approved by the Senate. It's because they didn't want to approve her. It's just because they had the Senate. They had majority in the Senate. They had majority in the House at that time when she was appointed. You got Biden coming off a controversial election with Trump. But they're feeling their oats. You got COVID and the beginnings of COVID. And so, my guess is they just didn't. They wanted her in place. And you'd be surprised how unlike what people perceive the government works, it actually is. It is very different than what you see on TV. It's very different than what we see in movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Nothing is done like that. It's not how Congress works. And even the association between Congress and the White House, like I alluded to with those two clauses, when I talked to law professors about this, they're aware of the conflation there. So it's not like people aren't unaware of it, but like 99% of other people aren't. So the White House can appoint somebody, a low-level, deputy secretary, and they may go through the process and you're just unaware of it. You don't know what happened. But it's already, the fix is in, not many Schedule C appointments get declined.
I remember reading very clearly, maybe it was on Yahoo News or so, that Dr. Walensky was approved or did not need Senate approval. She was just appointed from White House. But you are right about when we have pork barrel inserted into otherwise harmless or having some other intention for an act, say Patriot Act or NDAA, so that shows that things work very differently than what the cover says.
No, this is. I think your instincts are leading you in the right direction. But you can actually take this all the way back to 1789. Let's go to a famous one. 1794. President Washington calls up 13,000 troops. Where is the Article 2? Authority to call up 13,000 troops and then march them towards whiskey distillers, who are his competitors, by the way, out in western Pennsylvania. Where is the authority for that? It doesn't matter. This has become kind of my clarion call. It doesn't matter what you think the Constitution says or doesn't say. Originalism doesn't matter. Textualism doesn't matter. Pragmatism, interpretation of the Constitution doesn't matter. All that matters is who's in political power can do whatever they want, with an occasional slap down just to make it look different.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for taking my call.
What I wanted to throw in there, Ahmed, was, and you said about the whiskey tax rebellion, actually that was prohibited by the Constitution, Article 4, Section 4.
Good point.
Which made it totally unconstitutional because neither the governor nor the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania asked for that.
Right.
We've got one caller. Let's try to get in James from Vancouver before we run out of time here. James, how are you, sir?
Yes, sir, gentlemen. Good afternoon. I think one of the big players in the whole war for independence was the East India Company. I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Absolutely. And that was who Robert Morris and so many others were connected to, that East India Company. As a matter of fact, the ship that Morris and Willing had that they had contracted with the East India Company, the name of it was the Black Prince.
So you see, in this case, you have the vested interests of the East India Company. The idea is then you get the people to do the fighting, and then you don't have to give your George III. I think this is exactly the play they thought they were going to work out, you see. All righty.
Well, thanks James. And let's not forget that the Treaty of Paris, the Treaty of Paris said that King George III was the Prince of the United States.
Right. Well, actually, I got to tell you, one of my favorites has always been Ben Franklin. So I'll just leave you with that, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, James. Mark, we're rapidly running out of time. Would you kind of close us out here with your thoughts on today's program?
Yeah, I am absolutely privileged to be on here with you, Michael. It's been a real fun 2 hours, past 2 hours. I would only want to say one kind of closing thought, because one of the callers called in and wanted solutions, and everybody does when we have these conversations. It's like, okay, I agree. This is all a scam, and we got scammed. What do we do? Here's where I think the best way, this is how I look at it. I think light of truth is being shined in on this thing. And I think lies can only stay aloft for so long before they collapse under their own weight. I think this thing is headed for a major collapse, which is why this is an important discussion, because let's pretend in some period of time we end up with a massive depreciation of the dollar, or the BRICS take over and the dollar collapses, whatever that actually means economically. But we end up with a kind of a restart. We had doggone better know what not to do by examining our last 240 years. We better have these discussions right now, so this is very educational. It's not very oriented towards doing something other than getting truth back into your mind and blocking the lies. But we better head doggone better know what not to do should we be given a second bite at the apple to restart after this thing comes crashing down.
Well, Mark, I couldn't agree with you more. My point to people who say, well, what would you do? The thing I tell you is, if you are an alcoholic and you want to quit drinking, I mean, you want to not be an alcoholic, you got to quit drinking. So people quit acknowledging government and quit supporting it.
Yep. Amen to that, brother. Amen. So I thank you for having me on, man. This has been a blast. It's cathartic for me to talk to you.
My pleasure. I look forward to more endeavors together, Mark. And just can't thank you people enough who tune in. And we've had some great callers, some people with some great questions. Murr, can't thank you enough for talking about Chitango and those things. And you are a treasure in yourself. And Mark, again, brother, God bless you. God bless your family. Here comes our music. That's Roger Miller talking about government. Folks, have a beautiful, blessed week.
You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, you dat-gum, dat-gum, dat-gum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Gum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Do you get gum, get gum, get gum government? Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, you soul selling, no good sons of a shoe fitting fire starters.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network,
visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.